This is very exciting. I've known Dr. McCarthy since, I think, I've known Margaret since 1997, first met her. So I had ended up at the John Paul II Institute, didn't really know why, but I quit my full-time profession and decided to go to graduate school there. And then I was taking this class that really changed my life, and it was on theological anthropology. And I just, Margaret would come in, and I think she had a little one at the time, because she used to come in with all your professor papers and this little baby bag. So it was just great because it was a really beautiful course. I learned a lot about John Paul II's theology of the body, about the feminine genius, and I used to sit in that class and just sort of, it sort of really changed my perspective that we are loved for not for what we do, but for who we are. So, as I mentioned, Dr. McCarthy's been at the JP2 Institute since 1993. She is a convert, and I found that out from Father Gary Sellen way back when, so one of God's favorites. She is the editor, the U.S. editor for Humanen, which is a fantastic publication. So we have some of these cards if you'd like to take that. I encourage you to support it because they do some fabulous work and have great conferences down in Catholic U in D.C. And she's also a contributing editor to Communio, which is another fabulous publication. For those who know Dr. Schindler and a whole group of wonderful professors who contribute to that. So without further ado, she's going to be our kickoff speaker for the Feminine Genius series. And I'm really grateful she's doing this. She came back from Rome just a few days ago, has to teach class in the morning. So please welcome Margaret McCarthy.
Thank you so much for bearing up. I didn't know you were having a Feminine Genius series. I didn't realize that. Wow. Great, because that's what I'm talking about tonight, the feminine genius. What a coincidence. All right, so I don't know how much of this you want to hear, but the question about the feminine genius is really a question about sexual difference, since there is, of course, no feminine without a masculine, no woman without a man. They are correlative terms. This question about sexual difference has two levels. And we've just been introduced forcefully and violently to the second one. And it's kind of taken us all aback. But the first level is the one we're very familiar with, and it concerns the relation between man and woman. Here the issue is about the reality or the perception, I would say perception, that the woman's relation to a man has been, from time immemorial, one of subordination, household work being the main sign of this. This is the real hated thing is that women have an association with the house, the household. And that the situation is a product of society. It's called a social construct. Everyone says it, repeats it, and believes it. A social construct that's been imposed on reality. In particular, it's patriarchy that has done this. Patriarchy is the maleficent tool of clever men to subordinate and victimize women and keep them so. Simone de Beauvoir most represents this view when she says, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. This is the core thesis of most of feminism. The bullseye in the crosshairs of the feminist scope is therefore the very idea that women and men are indeed related to each other, made for each other, facing each other. This takes the form of either egalitarian feminism or difference feminism. If there is a relation, and of course men and women do still get together, and if Simone de Beauvoir herself had a long affair with Louis Sartre and loved him deeply and wept at his funeral, it's a very beautiful picture with her weeping over his beer. There is only one. If there is a relation, the point is that there is only a relation on the basis of choice. In other words, the point is that the relation between men and women is not in the nature of things. The point is, if we have a relation with each other, it's only because we've chosen to. This debate, as we know, has been going on for more than a century, and the homosexual movement is one of its many roots. Okay. So there's been this sort of toxic account of the relation between man and woman. It has thus bred more toxicity, and so men and women are now going their separate ways and doing things more easily with members of the same sex. The second level is the one that we are now on, and perhaps a bit It's alarming because it gets to happen so quickly. Even if the ground for this level was laid by the feminist problem, if you will, and it's called the gender ideology. Gender ideology concerns not so much my relation to the opposite sex, but my relation with my own body. According to its main claim, there are body parts, I have body parts, on the one hand, and an identity on the other. Sometimes they match up, sometimes they don't. The bullseye in the crosshairs of this ideology's scope is the very idea that my being a woman is rooted in the nature of things and has something to do with the nature of my being, and is therefore at the heart of my identity. The point is that even if most of us are cisgender, that is, lined up with our body parts, this statistical alignment is just a choice. If I'm cisgender, if I'm lined up, if I have a female identity lined up with my female body parts, it's because I've chosen that. So my son at Notre Dame last year, he was introduced to his freshman year with a black man who was in charge of his introduction to the freshman year, and he stood up like this and he said, "My name is so-and-so, I identify as Episcopal priest, and I identify as a black man." And my son said, "Why do you say identify? You are black." I love that story. The second level, but that's the point, is that all of the kids, they all talk this way, and it means I choose to be black. Okay, good. That's good. In your case. The second level, the question about sexual difference, wants to deal a final blow to the relation between the sexes by getting us to think that notwithstanding the evidence before our very eyes, there is no there. So I suggest it's a new take on the Emperor's New Clothes story. Because there, the idea was to make people believe that there was a cloak. In this case, the cloak is gender. It's actually invisible because it's made up. But it quite successfully hides the reality of the naked body lying underneath it. So what we're now doing is hiding the naked body. But the whole point, and here's where it comes back to the women's genius, I mean, sort of what's to blame for all this? I mean, there's something much older to blame for this, of course, is the whole women and men question. Why do we do this? Why do we inflict this divorce between ourselves and our bodies so that we can say ultimately that really our relation to men, there's really no there. There's no there. There's nothing really binding about my being a woman. There's nothing binding me to men in my being a woman. Benedict summed up both of these issues really beautifully in a very prophetic speech he gave shortly before he resigned. The famous saying of Simone de Beauvoir, "One is not born a woman, one becomes so," lay the foundation for what is put forward today under the term gender as a new philosophy of sexuality. According to this philosophy, sex is no longer a given element of nature that man has to accept and personally make sense of. It is a social role that we choose for ourselves, while in the past it was chosen for us by society. So that's the point. So Simone de Beauvoir said gender, I mean, she didn't use that word, but it's basically a social construct that's been sort of forced on us by the bad men. Now what's going on is we ourselves, that is bad, and we're not supposed to allow that to happen, but it's okay if we do it to ourselves. So now we are constructing ourselves by calling myself Fred or black or I'm African, I'm 3 years old, I'm whatever I want to be. For Benedict, there are cosmic proportions underlying the sexual difference question. And the question really ultimately is, do we want to be creatures? Do we accept or do we not the fact that we're creatures? In his book, Introduction to Christianity, he had noted the problem of creatureliness to be at the heart of the current zeitgeist. Man, he said, is no longer what he is by virtue of his being, but rather by virtue of what is feasible or makeable. This preceded the gender question, this idea that we aren't really something. I mean, it used to be that people accepted that I'm first something and then I act upon that. Now it's I am insofar as I can make something, make myself something. Every age has its issue, but these issues always involve everything. And so he's saying that sort of the everything here is whether or not we're creatures. That's what's going on in this whole sexual difference, these sexual difference questions. Sexual difference is our question in this age. One of the French feminists, a difference feminist, Luce Irigaray, said, "Sexual difference is one of the important questions of our age, if not, in fact, the burning issue. Each age is preoccupied with one thing and one alone. Sexual difference is probably that issue in our age, which could be our salvation at an intellectual level." It was from this global perspective that John Paul II, in his Apostolic Letter on Women, set out to understand the reason for and the consequences of the Creator's decision that the human being should always and only exist as a woman or man. So he understood that this question of being man or woman had to do with something at the very origin of creation, and therefore affected the whole thing. He understood that everything was in question. So what I would suggest here is a way of, before we start, to say that sort of what had been made problematic in their mind had to do with a kind of revisiting of original sin. That what's going on, not just in every age, we're always revisiting original sin and every sin we commit, of course, but that this sort of, these tensions that have been really exacerbated in the field of sexual difference are a kind of deep-seated expression of original sin. One, just the rejection that we're creatures, so it's a rejection of our relation with God, and then that this, at the heart of this tension is the fact that we really are. I mean, there's an enmity between us, and that's a fact. That's a fact. Original, you know, the Genesis tells us that when original sin occurred, that there was these consequences, and then the first fallout of original sin would be the way men and women treat each other. So we have to take this seriously, that this is not just an ideas war, but these ideas themselves are the embodiment or the expression of this enmity that really is between man and woman. You know, we need to face that. What is at stake in this question of sexual difference? So I'm going to suggest two things. The first is choice, and the second is equality. Why is it that so much is at stake with the question of sexual difference? In my judgment, it's because the body as sexually distinct is the last bastion of resistance to the century-old projects of emancipation from relations that I find myself in prior to choice. And I would say this is not just a left-wing Marxist issue. This is as much a liberal capitalist issue as it is a left-wing issue. It's very much embedded in John Locke and in the tradition that he spawned. Being sexual, there are three things that we have to note. We have to say these obvious things. Now that all this is sort of put into question, we have to start thinking, well, what's going on here? What does it mean to be sexual? And I would suggest to you that there are three things that really offend the current culture, the current zeitgeist. The first is that to be sexual is to be a being that was born. Sexuality has something to do with reproduction. That means I was reproduced, right? Being sexual, we are children, we are sons and daughters, and we owe our existence, therefore, to others. My very being as a sexual being, being sexual, I know that my very being is an inheritance. I didn't just get my parents' eye color, just their hair color, their money, their property. I got my very being from them. My whole being is shot through with this fact of being an inheritance. Then, secondly, being sexual, we're already poised. I'm already in a relation to the opposite sex, quite apart from whether or not, you know, I either meet John or marry John or whatever. Already from the day I'm conceived, I'm already in a relation to the opposite sex. For to say male or to say female is to always already have the opposite in view. It makes no sense to talk about one without the other. Finally, to be sexual, we're also always already potentially mothers or fathers. Here, even our future is not simply in our hands. Our lives are not the product to say this, to say that I'm always already potentially a mother means that all my future is not simply the product of a 5-year plan. It's not simply the product of a choice. With the inbuilt tendency towards motherhood and fatherhood, in our inbuilt tendency toward the opposite sex, life is more of an adventure, something with surprises along the way, things not in our control. Maybe you can't even have a child. Maybe your child is profoundly disabled. Maybe you have too many children. Maybe you'll be really poor and you can't feed them, and so on. I mean, we all could say in different ways how much just this fact of being mothers took us in directions that we could never have imagined, you know, before we were married. I think often of what Jesus said to Peter, you know, when you grow old, you will have a cord tied around your waist and you'll be taken where you know not where. And that's very much, a vocation is like that. You're sort of throwing yourself into the deep and binding your future to another. And it's not a 5-year plan, put it that way. In each case, being born, being always already facing the opposite sex, being always already a potential father or mother, I am already always in a relation, which constitutes me, even before I choose it. None of these things are things I choose. I didn't choose to be born. And here we have the whole gamut of my life, the past, being born, present, facing the opposite sex, the future, you know, where my future takes me through my children. These are all things that are, if you will, already spoken for. They're already spoken for. Now, all of these dimensions of sexual difference offend against a basic pillar of our thinking about ourselves, and that is self-determination. You probably remember the famous words of Justice Kennedy, who said in the Casey case, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of the meaning of the universe, and of the mystery of human life, no less." It's quite a statement. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, the meaning of the universe, and the mystery of human life. That's a mouthful. Anyway, he gave us a lot of good quotes for our papers, but this one has gotten a lot of track. Even more, being in these relations, we are face-to-face with members of society who are considered to be, in principle, alien to us. That is not natural. So according to the state of nature doctrine that John Locke and Hobbes and Rousseau gave us, and that undergirds both liberalism and socialism, so both the left and both the right, hold at the bottom, the anthropology is an anthropology of the so-called state of nature, where we are, in principle, not related to each other. We are not related to each other. We are noble savages. We are, in principle, we are alone by definition. And then we come together by virtue of contracts, and the state's job is to guard these contracts, make sure we don't impinge too much on the other person's freedom. Of course, there are people, you know, like Sartre, the existentialist atheist, who call the other hell. But, you know, there are conservative versions of this, too. This is really clear when we talk about sexuality in terms of protection or danger or safety or contracts. College students now have apps on their phones with contracts, and as they move through their nightly events, you know, they have to sign off on certain stages of the hookup and sign a contract. It's crazy. And of course, sir, we already know about nuptial contracts. That's old hat. The idea is that since a man and a woman and child are in principle aliens to each other, there must therefore be safety measures put in place to protect us from dangerous liaisons. We have to appreciate what's going on. The state is not there to protect us. It's really clear now. We can really see things for what they are. Sort of something that was happening 3 centuries ago. Is that it's not just that the state's there to protect us from the odd murderer and the odd robber, but he's there to protect us from each other. Okay. And this is really clear now, I mean, with children's rights, that the child, the state's starting to come in and move in to guarantee the child, if you will, protection from its parents. Right? Because if you think, according to this logic, to be born is the worst offense of all. It's just about the worst thing that could happen to you to be born, because you owe your entire being to someone else. A very, very interesting feminist who had been a Orthodox Jew, her name is Shulamith Firestone, wrote this 40 years ago. And here she's talking about how everything about the family has to be emancipated, but her quote ends by talking about how the child itself has to be emancipated from birth. It's a little funky, because how do you do that? Well, you can do it. She says, the reproduction of the species by one sex for the benefit of both should be replaced by artificial reproduction. Children will be born to both sexes equally or independently of either, however we choose to look at it. The dependence of the child on the mother would give way to a greatly shortened dependence on a small group of others in general, and any remaining inferiority to adults would be compensated for. In sum, the gamut of relations that sexual difference implies for us puts us at risk insofar as we understand ourselves to be selves, defining our own concept of existence. So Ratzinger wrote a really fantastic article on freedom, and it's really interesting because he says the child in the womb is the sort of fundamental expression of what it means to be a human being, which is, as he says, a being from and a being for. And the baby in the womb is this radical being from. And he says the culture of death, the reason we need abortion so badly is not just for the mother's freedom to be able to have the future she wants to have, but that the child in the womb as a figure is an offense against our concept of human existence. The child itself, it's a figure, it's just got to go. You know, because it represents everything we hate.
So there's also the question of equality. The dominant notion of equality, the modern one, but also the ancient one, is an equality of essentially of sameness and interchangeability. So the old idea, the ancient idea, is that you always equalize things that are greater and lesser. So if you have one child is 5 marbles and one child is 3, you make them equal by removing the difference, right? Give one to this child, and now they've each got, what is it, 4? Something like that. So the concept is that equality is always against the backdrop of an inferior and a superior, right? So where there's a difference, it's inferior and superior. It was a mathematical idea in the ancient world. But that's the idea we're working with now. That's the dominant idea, that where you have difference, you necessarily have inequality. You have inferiority and superiority. Given this point of view, sexual difference is a slap in the face. With sexual difference, there are the different dispositions, attitudes, tendencies, propensities, like single-mindedness. Men are more single-minded, multitasking for women. But these are tendencies, and there are always lots of exceptions. But there are also activities that are specific to each of the sexes in a mutually exclusive way. A man, for example, just for starters, does not conceive, does not bear, does not give birth, does not nurse a child. And a woman, well, doesn't beget one. The man generates outside of himself, always, and the woman generates inside herself, always. Those are mutually exclusive things that they do. There's no sameness there, and there's no interchangeability. The upshot of this state of affairs is that man and woman have to do their specific work of making a family together, face to face. Since they both can't do the same things, and he's got something I don't have, and I've got something he doesn't have, we've got to come together. That's the idea. Notice the beauty of this is it's the price precisely at this point of limit. I don't have everything, he doesn't have everything, that you get a baby. You get a baby out of that. You know? Something very beautiful is born of this. What in modern terms of equality looks like an offense that I don't have everything, and therefore we've got to come together and depend on each other. Well, in the very sort of sexual act and the reproduction of humanity, it's precisely that not having everything that bears this beautiful fruit.
Christianity was revolutionary 2,000 years ago when it revealed that God, in God, he is one and three, the three persons, each of them do something different. Each of them do something different that the other doesn't do. And yet, they are, the fathers insisted they are utterly equal. There's no greater and lesser. And this is really a revolution. It took 4 centuries of tearing our hair out, of figuring this out, because it just, in the ancient mind, if someone's doing something different and if he comes from the Father, then he has to be lesser. They were called subordinationists. That was Arianism. People fought, people died to say no, that's not the case. Anyway, but we've forgotten this. When we see difference, we assume inequality, especially where the feminine is concerned. Okay. Let me just note that in this drive towards this kind of equality of sameness and interchangeability, we should note how unequal things are for the women. It's the woman's body and the woman's heart that has to be suppressed, beginning with the suppression of her cycle with the pill. Then the burying of the co-ed's desire for a guy who will love her forever with binge drinking before the hookup. Then with her taking care of things in the event of a slip-up, abortion. Then with her putting her ideal fertility window on hold with corporate egg freezing programs. This is one of the biggest gifts given to girl daughters graduating from law school is a package for freezing her eggs. It's a new gift now. It's a new gift. In exchange, and with her, therefore, having to defer motherhood, and eventually, with her, having to walk into a fertility clinic and undergo the humiliating procedures that we know about, all so that she can be equal, all so she can lean in and get her ducks in a row, right? So, but it's a very interesting, it's tragic, but it's also interesting from the point of view of equality, because you have to ask after all this, which kind of equality is this? That has her so unequally suppressing herself. The men don't suppress anything about themselves. They're free. All right, so it's in the context of this that we bring up the feminine genius. Here we have the possibility to breathe, to think, not in terms of this inferiority complex of the feminine that always has to be put down in order for us to be equal. And so that we can also flourish together with our counterpart, because again, to be a woman, to be feminine, is to be with a counterpart. By feminine genius, John Paul II referred to a talent or an intelligence specific to women, something she has by virtue of her specific difference with respect to man. This particular genius does not exclude other forms of genius. He did not mean that. Such as, for example, in fields of mathematics, science, literature, etc. Geniuses which belong to humanity as such. The common humanity we share with men. But our specific genius is specific to us, to her, as distinct from man's genius and in relation to that genius. Moreover, it's not just one of many geniuses. It's the one through which she bears all her other geniuses. In the same way that all of our bodily organs, which we share with men, we all have hearts and kidneys and lungs, but all of those bodily organs at the cellular level are shot through with the feminine and masculine difference. As you know, every cell has the chromosomes, the livers, the skin, everything. So I would argue that for John Paul II, the feminine genius is also not just lined up with many other geniuses, but it's sort of shot through all the geniuses. All right. Now, what is the feminine genius? What is it? As the Pope understood, the feminine genius is an intelligence or sensitivity tied to the fact that we are apt to receive in ourselves the man and thereby apt for maternity. By virtue of the fact that fact, we, the woman, is able to welcome a child, give it room, and enable it to grow. The woman is literally the place where the human being comes to be, is allowed to be, and respected in its otherness. I'm quoting John Paul II. Because of this aptitude, a woman has a special openness to the person as a being for his own sake. I'm using his quotes. That is, not as a means to an end, but a being for its own sake. In sum, and I quote him again, we are entrusted with the human being in a special way. By virtue of the fact that the human being simply finds his first home in her. The first home is us. We are the first home. Two caveats should be made here. The first is that the genius, this aptitude for motherhood, it does not depend on a woman actually physically being a mother. It depends on the kind of being that we are, or being apt for motherhood. The second point is that this aptness for physical motherhood is itself iconic of something deeper. So that, as we know in our Catholic tradition, and John Paul II said this, Pope Francis has said this, the vocation of virginity is a kind of motherhood, and it reveals to something deeper. Another characteristic of the feminine genius to note is the hiddenness of this genius. The first sphere of action of the feminine genius is in the womb, then in the home. And therefore, it is a sphere that's fairly inconspicuous, where there's a lot of stuff is going on, but it's really inconspicuous. A lot goes on in the womb. It's really fascinating. The more we learn about embryonic development, there's so much that's going on, but no one sees it. Though the work tide of the feminine genius is made up of hundreds and thousands of small, repetitive actions, wiping counters, often which appear insignificant and fruitless, it's not performed by someone with a position or some other form of public recognition, and it does not garner a salary. There's no wage. But for all of this, the work of the feminine genius is not less important. We might say that it's more important. The most important forms of work were never given a wage. They were given honoraria. You know, the Pope doesn't get a salary, right? And that's because the intuition is that when you do something that's good for its own sake, you sort of step out of the world of commerce, right? So the work of the feminine genius is a work that is tied to something that's good in itself. It's not for something else. Okay, why is the feminine genius invoked? It sort of helps to understand what something is when you realize, well, why are we bringing it up now? What's the point? For John Paul II, but also others, he usually invoked the feminine genius on account of concerns about certain cultural tendencies which make the world unhomelike. Tendencies in modern business management, bureaucracy, which crush the person under its dominant categories of efficiency and productivity. So think of the little bureaucratic, you know, regimes where everyone's in their cubicle, right? And everyone's just a little sort of peon, right? But also the tendencies in science and technology, which, and I'm quoting him, push others to the edges of society, especially the most vulnerable. So I'm referring to the dominant way in which we look at nature today as raw matter, with no life of its own. The Pope Francis spoke about this in Laudato Si, where he spoke about the technocratic paradigm, which is where you look at nature as just raw matter. And the point is there, if you look at it raw matter, then you can do, if you look at nature as just raw matter, you can do whatever you want with it. That's the point. So you deprive it of its nature, and that way you could have a field day, right? Indeed, it's very interesting that other word, material, the ancient concept of matter was tied to, well, the ancient word in Greek was houle, which literally means wood, the wood of a tree. But then in Latin it was transferred, so the wood of a tree is something alive, it's something growing, it's not just raw matter, it's got a life of its own, right? But then when the Latins came along, they gave the word houle materia, which is close to the word mater, mother. And the idea is there is that motherhood is it represents a kind of maternal potency in things. It's not just raw matter. And also are responsible for protecting the nature of things. That's what she's doing as she's allowing the human being to grow in herself, not letting it be just raw matter. All of this, as John Paul II, leads to a gradual loss of sensitivity for man, for what is essentially human. This is what's meant by cultural homelessness. There's no longer a place where the human being can be at home. He's simply left out in the cold. Then, too, there's the fact that a culture placing, when a culture no longer places a value on the very being and the place where that very being protects things and lets them be what they are, the beings for their own sake, we have another phenomenon, and that is that women themselves, who are attuned to harboring and making a home for human existence, and all the activity that goes with that that's inefficient, multitasking, unproductive, laborious, repetitive, inconspicuous, women themselves jettison their genius and jump on board to be where the action is, valuing only those activities which are publicly recognized and reimbursed, and which then perpetuate the homelessness of the world. So I think this is a tragedy of so many. I'm not against women being in the public sphere, obviously. First of all, I think the home is public. But it's just such a tragedy where so many public women are women that have jettisoned. They're in the public sphere not qua women, but as women who've jettisoned their feminine genius and are doing the very things to perpetuate the homelessness of culture. Okay, in sum, the feminine genius is often invoked as a counterbalance to these disturbing trends. Okay, note that the technocratic paradigm that Francis speaks about is often associated with a bad form of masculinity. So more on that in a minute. But we should be clear that it's a bad form of masculinity. It's not masculinity, but bad masculinity. So, women and society. How much time is it? Not much time left. What's the time? 10 minutes? Okay. I got 10 minutes. Okay. I don't want to bore you guys. Okay. Let's talk about women in society then, because I was just in Rome at a meeting and there's sort of an older style of women who sort of really lived off of feminism, and for them it's just about the evilest thing that it's just a sign of evil in the world that women, you know, were made to be at home. I mean, there's a sort of image that men were sort of barring the door from every kind of public activity. They were stuffed in the house or something, which is a kind of odd narrative. But anyway, it's a very dominant view. Whether that was the case or not, I'm sure men have done a lot of bad things, of course. It's just so women. I'm an equal opportunity person. I think we're both capable of just as much evil. But regardless of the ways in which the division of labor has been infelicitous, there's generally a view in feminist parlance, in feminist thinking, that the home is just about the worst place you could possibly be. You know. So anyway, so let's say a word about women in society. Let me note three things. In the first instance, let me make an obvious point, but one which is often left aside in discussions about women in society, the role of women in society. I was at the meeting with the role of women in the church, and the assumption is that the church is always, you know, the Vatican, right? Yeah. Okay. So when we talk about the role of women in society, we mean, of course, politics, right? Of course. Society must first value the work specific to women, the work tied to her conceiving, bearing, nursing, and raising children. Work that is made of thousands of small, repetitive actions and done gratis. Chesterton captured this profoundly in his uniquely quotable way. He said, "When people begin to talk about domestic duty as not merely difficult but trivial and dreary, I simply give up. For I cannot, with the utmost energy of imagination, conceive what they mean. When domesticity is called drudgery, all the difficulty arises from a double meaning in the word. If drudgery only means dreadfully hard work, I admit the woman drudges in the home, as a man might drudge at the cathedral or drudge behind a gun at Trafalgar. But if it means that the hard work is more heavy because it's trifling, colorless, and of small import, then I say I give up. I do not know what the words mean. I can understand how this might exhaust the mind, but I cannot imagine how it could narrow the mind. How can it be a large career to tell other people's children about the rule of three, and a small career to tell one's children about the universe? How can it be broad to be the same thing to everyone and narrow to be everything to someone? No, a woman's function is laborious, not because it's... No, a woman's function is laborious, but because it's gigantic, not because it's minute. So he had this, you know, he wrote this in his wonderful essays that he wrote in the newspaper, and he had this idea that a man really is more typically specified. His work, he tends to specify more. And he had a real... He was fighting the equity feminists of his day. And they wanted all the women to get up and get out of their houses and go to the factory, basically. You know? And he saw that there was something crazy about that. You know? Anyway, valuing the work specific to women means also to privilege... So, first of all, Chesterton, first of all, value it. In our own minds, we need to value it. Then society needs to privilege it. And I refer to the fact that having and raising a family affects a woman differently than a man, that it requires, on the part of the woman, time, lots of time, and not just quality time, quantity time. We should appreciate this in the bare facts of life, the process of conception. I mean, it couldn't be more stark. For a man, you know, for us, the egg has been sitting there since we were in our own mother's womb. Isn't that unbelievable? You become pregnant at age 40, and that egg has been there for 40 years, plus 9 months. It's unbelievable. And the sperm is just sort of constantly, you know. And then for a man, blah, blah, blah. You know the humor about all of this. So the time element for a woman, you know, as opposed to the man, I mean, couldn't be more opposite, right? So, John Paul Ratzinger, when he was... Before, under John Paul II, he, in a wonderful document on Men and Women, he said that society really needs to go out of its way to make it economically possible for women to stay at home. I mean, especially when they want to. In other words, it should be easy for them to do, not harder. Some political theorists, like John Rawls, their view is that, again, domestic labor is guilty until proven innocent. So society should make it more difficult to stay at home. The tax structure should make it more difficult. So that if you decide, you're really deciding on a choice. Okay, so that's because you already have a negative idea of domestic work. And you don't appreciate that it weighs on a woman differently. I mean, we could talk about the way hormones work. And if you're nursing, if you're taking your body seriously, you nurse. Because, you know, your milk didn't just appear in that place just arbitrarily. It appears in a place where the child can see the mother's face. I mean, that can't be simply arbitrary. And that means time, that means hormones that are being released that attach you to the child in a way that the father isn't. It's just simple. Second point, relation between home and society. In the second instance, we should have to recognize that women are already in society, thank you very much, through their specific work. Indeed, they are generating society. The family is the first and vital cell. All right, so this is a point that liberal political theorists really don't think that the family is part of society. It's sort of out there in the hinterland somewhere. All right. So that's a real problem. So whenever we talk about women in society, we have to realize that there's always this prejudice that they're not already in society, that the home sort of doesn't belong to society. It's out in the suburbs somewhere, which is usually, unfortunately, the case. But anyway. And of course, this is exacerbated by the fact that, I mean, there's so much you could talk about with the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution really took out all of the vital activity in the home. I mean, the home used to be a place of cottage industry, and you really could see that really society was going on in the house. Now, it wasn't just a place to go to sleep at night. It wasn't a dormitory. And I refer you to Dorothy Sayers, who said, the first great insult was that men were taken out of the home. That is, all of meaningful work. And then women left. They all went to their little factory to put swiggles on cupcakes, as Chesterton said, you know.
The baker used to be able to make a lot of different breads, and now what does the baker do? And on the assembly line, he puts a squiggle on a cupcake, you know, for 8 monotonous hours a day, right? So there's a lot that has to be said there about the way in which home and society have been set apart from each other, even geographically. And it's true what Betty Friedan says, in my opinion, that the home is a comfortable concentration camp because nothing's going on there. So I think she's right. And so to address this problem, you have to address the nature of work and appreciate the interest in craft industry that's going on now with our sons who are interested in making beer and all that. Anyway, presence of women in society in a sort of more technical, narrow sense. I think it's a narrower sense, but it's okay. But the place of women in society is not reduced as to the question of whether or not the woman stays in the home in the literal sense. The point is not that all women need to remain always in the home as mothers, but that they should retain their intrinsic relation to home and maternity, even as or if they enter the culture and engage in its public activities. The point is that a woman is always a mother, whether physically or spiritually, and that all her activity, both private and public, I don't like those terms, but they ought to be pursued from the point of view of her making the culture more of a home, home-like. That is, from the point of view of her genius. Here, then, we can evaluate the presence of women in society in a more specific, though limited, sense. I think it's more limited. We return to the specific reason in modernity for turning so urgently to the feminine genius, which is to humanize structures. I mean, John Paul spoke about that. Women can humanize. Edith Stein spoke about that, even in the factory, which was so dehumanizing. Women's presence in the factories, that was just what was going on. She thought it could be humanizing. I'm not sure if that's the case, but why not? Okay. And I do think that this kind of presence is sorely needed, both because of the cultural homelessness, but also on account of the fact that so many of today's public women are perpetuating that homelessness through their actions directed against the family and the home. There's a really interesting group of women that were in FDR's administration. They were called the Maternalists. They were all in the Democrat Party, which was the party that was pro-family, pro-natalist, and they fought for the family wage. They fought against the equity feminists, who were always in bed with the industrialists, fighting against child labor laws. They're very interesting people. So some of the first women in the administration of a president were these women who were maternalists. Anyway. Okay. And finally, just as a teaser, we can maybe talk about this together, because a friend of mine has really convinced me that really this all this talk about feminine genius just really has got to stop unless we talk about the masculine genius. It just doesn't make sense. So here's what I have so far on that. So just as a teaser for further discussion, let me just hint what I think is the masculine genius. Then show that each genius is in relation to the other, obviously, and corrects also the sinful tendencies of the other. The masculine genius, in my view, refers the woman to the fact that she is not the origin and source of the life she carries. She is only mother of all living because of something that comes from outside her. This is kind of obvious anatomy here. But it's not so obvious. And early cultures who were pantheistic and had mother goddesses weren't quite clear about that. Or if they were clear about it, they suppressed it. What's really obvious is you have a baby that comes out of the body of a mother. It's clear who the source of that baby is. It wasn't so obvious. After all, the thing that happened was 9 months before, right? So it was very easy to suppress the father's contribution. In any event, as many have said, noted that a patriarchal religion, that is, with a God who is a father, is a religion that understands that the source of the world's life is from outside of itself.
that the world is not Mother Nature. It doesn't birth itself. Okay, it doesn't give itself its own life. So the masculine genius is the genius is to represent this transcendent source of life. Judaism and Christianity, in fact, call God Father just for this reason. The world does not sort of recreate itself and recreate itself. The world does not have its life by virtue of itself, but by virtue of something outside itself. Okay. So the man is the humble reminder of this fact in the case of every new little being that comes into the world. And he's a humble reminder because, of course, he himself is born of woman. So he's playing God, but it's obviously pathetic. I mean, so it's a tough role to play. As for how do they correct each other? Just as Judaism and Christianity correct pantheistic tendencies typical in the ancient world, but they also correct. The God as Father corrects pantheistic tendencies, but also the masculine genius corrects the tendencies of each woman who knows well her power to think that Mother Nature is the sole origin of life. And I believe that this tendency in us, we who experience motherhood, there really is a tendency to think that we're really it, that we really created this thing. And I have to say, I've definitely experienced this. And that's precisely the place where we can go to look for female violence. We know a lot about male violence, patriarchy, raping and pillaging and all that. But women have another kind of violence, and I think it's tied to this idea that they are the sole creator, origin, and possessor of that little life. And of course, I think abortion is the symbol of that. But Jung, the psychoanalyst, spoke about two kinds of mothers. There's the benevolent mother and the cruel mother. And you could think of the two women who came to Solomon. One was benevolent. These two figures. And we all know, all of us women know this well. We know how well we can be possessive and so on. So, headship. The idea of headship, which is straight in the Bible, and I love it, means literally origin and source. The man as head represents this source and origin of life that comes outside from the world and outside the woman. And as we said, the woman also corrects the sinful tendencies of man. What are the sinful tendencies of men? So the sinful tendency of women is to be the sort of, overbearing, sole possessor of the child, right? Sinful tendencies of men are neglect and abuse. Neglect and abuse. His tendencies are to turn away from the woman and to turn away from nature, if you will, and then to turn on it and abuse it. And so for him to be told to be a head is also a correction of him, because it tells him, it asks him to radiate, to be the representative of God's fatherhood, to turn his vitality towards the woman and bear life with her and protect it, to be a father. So there you go. So anyway, in all of this, we can see that there's this sort of war between the battle of the sexes is kind of raging on right now, and gender is just a sort of chapter in that war. And there's a lot that can be said intellectually about this, and in sort of tracing the intellectual history of all this stuff, and I can do that, but I do think that intellectual history is itself an expression of something, a sort of a deep-seated effect of original sin in each of us. So I don't actually believe that the solution is simply by setting everybody straight with ideas, although I think ideas are important. But it would really take, I mean, the novelty of Christianity really brings to the world a new presence in the form of a man and a bride, a spouse, and a bride who's a mother. And then in the presence of these two exceptional presences in the world, we can gladly recuperate and accept this feminine and this masculine genius. That's...